Hey everybody, Virgil Texas here with Matt Chrisman. Today we are going to take a brief reprieve from the darkness that's slowly consuming us all to talk Hollywood. Sitting with us is Mike Reese, screenwriter, playwright, TV writer, TV producer, published author, known for co-creating The Critic, creating Queer Duck, and best known, of course, for his long-running involvement in the cultural phenomenon, paramount artistic achievement that changed the face of comedy, Homeboys in Outer Space. Mike, what was it like to work with the Flex?
He was all right. That was a really nice job at Homeboys in Outer Space. I think it was because we knew we were creating art.
It really felt like those homeboys were in outer space.
It's fun. You know, this is where we lose the entire audience as I talk for the next half hour about homeboys in outer space.
You'd be surprised. That would be a landmark episode for us.
Okay. But I mean, it was even at the time I worked there, the show came on the air and no one would believe it, but the LA Times said, this is the best new comedy of the year. And that was why I went there. I was helping a friend, but it looked special. And by the time the network and the studio got done with it, it was gone after 17 episodes, at which time it was considered one of the 50 worst shows of all time. And I've just never seen, I don't think it was ever going to be great art, but it was, I've never seen that level of kind of interference with a show before.
And as you write in your memoirs published this month, Springfield Confidential, Jokes, Secrets, and Outright Lies from a Lifetime of Writing for The Simpsons, that premise of two kind of buffoonish delivery men in outer space was recycled to make Futurama.
It's Futurama. It's just, you watch the show, it's Futurama. I'm not accusing Matt Groening or David Cohen of stealing it because I don't think they were big fans. I don't think they were among the five or six people watching the show, but it is too. It's impressive that they had found all new writers for this show. It was a guy named Eric Van Lowe created it. And as soon as the show went off the air, four of them went off and created Family Guy. One of them we poached and brought him right over to Simpsons. And then he created F is for Family, which is a big animated hit on Netflix. So everybody, you know, emerged unscathed from the thing. And one of the actors on the show, the funniest guy, not Flex, one of the funniest guy on the show, we brought him right over to The Simpsons, and he's our newest voice actor, Kevin Michael Richardson.
Well, you're going to get a nasty DM from Flex.
I'm here for it. I'm here for Flex beef.
as I said, your memoir has been released this month. And I read it. I finished reading it last night. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it. There were a lot of spoofs and goofs and gags and gossip. And yeah, my question for you is, what is your ghostwriter secret?
I'll tell you how it came about. This guy, Matthew Klickstein, who I'd never met. He'd phoned me.
He wrote our book, too.
He phoned me. He's the guy. He wrote an oral history of the Nickelodeon Network that was actually a bestseller, very well loved. So he called me and he said, Mike, you and me are going to go on the road and we're going to see Mike Reese's America. That's going to be the book and there won't be any Simpsons in it at all. And we're here 2 years later. It's all Simpsons. I've never been in a car with the guy. We didn't go anywhere. I wrote the book too. This is a real kind of writer's vanity. I got to say, he did some great stuff. If you actually did read the book, he interviewed all my coworkers and colleagues and all the way. And these are my, what people I thought were my friends, but they don't return my calls. But he talked to Judd Apatow and John Lovitz, and we drop it in throughout the book where I'm telling my story. And then John Lovitz gives his version of it. Judd Apatow, he got him to write the introduction.
It's basically a Rashomon story with John Lovitz.
Yes. Yes, it is. John, he's, you know, he was dragged into doing The Critic. He really, really didn't want to do it. And now it's all he wants to do. He really wants to reboot the show.
Yeah, that was an interesting part of it. So you and your former partner don't want to do The Critic. And I assume all of Hollywood doesn't want to do it either. But, and Lovitz is just practically begging in your book to just do The Critic again. And I'll be the first to volunteer. I'll do it.
You'll do The Critic.
Matt will probably, you'll do it.
Well, in what sense?
We just need somebody to make the critic so we can do the voice.
So we would make the critic in the year.
Yeah, how hard could it be?
It's a little outreach. You know, we're just trying to give poor John Lovitz a job. I just don't want to go back and do the critic again. It's the show, even when the critic was when the critic character was successful, it was kind of a depressing show. And now he's clearly, the character must have fallen low because there's no more TV critics.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. What would Jay Sherman be doing? Would he be like a Yelp power user?
God.
Grim.
Well, you did bring the critic back for that series of vignettes for online.
Yes, that was very frustrating, too.
I remember watching those, and like the tone was completely different. He was married?
I think he had a girlfriend. I don't remember them well. It was something... They came to us, it was during the dot-com boom, and they said, the critic can do what he's never done. You know, a movie can be in theaters this week, and you can have the parody on the air, online, next week. And we said, great, you know, quickie, flash animation. So we made these 10 episodes, and then they just sat on them. They sat on them for a solid year, and we kept saying, what are you doing? And they said, we're debugging them. So by the time they came on the air, they were parodies of movies nobody remembered. You know, big, you know, we did an episode parodying Blink, the Madeline Stowe movie. And so.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, yeah. It's a classic.
Classic. I think
ask your parents. ask your friends. They're always talking about Blink.
Just don't ask me.
That was it. It took longer to get them online than it did to get a regular episode of The Critic on the air. So very frustrating, stupid experience. And we weren't getting paid for it.
That sounds like the internet.
Well, we cracked the code. We're getting paid for it. We're getting paid to talk about movies that nobody remembers.
That's true.
Questionable quality.
Well, you say that, but I think Gotti will be remembered for generations to come. So
I'm thinking more about The Cobbler.
The Cobbler. We saw The Cobbler.
Well, you're the target audience for The Cobbler.
We were alone, and it's one of those movies. It was just my wife and I in the theater where you're thinking, the movie, the characters might as well talk to us. You know, it's just Adam Sandler could be going, Mike, I don't know whether I should keep making shoes or not.
That's a magical experience, and that's happened to me exactly once when I was in college. I had this friend, and for a week, he just kept talking about this movie and quoting from the trailer. It was an obnoxious trailer, and then we went and saw it. We were the only ones in the theater, and that movie was Wild Hogs.
Wild Hogs? Oh, the motorcycle movie?
Yes.
And there was, they had the script. They were ready to make Wild Hogs 2. It was all ready to roll, and then...
They weren't able to make a sequel because there was that biker massacre in Texas, and they thought, oh, it's a little poor taste.
You know, no
more
such
movies.
Thing as bad publicity.
So you were...
I know once we leave The Cobbler and we're never coming back...
You'd be surprised.
I sold a script to Adam Sandler, a dramatic script, and he was going to do it, and he said, and we've got this director we love. There was a whole package ready to roll, depending on the success of The Cobbler. We were going to reunite team. And so it was just this horrible feeling to walk into the theater, and it's just me and the wife, and I go, it's not happening.
Wait, why was it contingent on The Cobbler being successful?
We wanted to reunite the director of The Cobbler and Adam Sandler with my script.
No, not that you wrote like Cobbler fan fiction.
I wrote Cobbler too.
It was like a 50 Shades type situation.
It does suggest a sequel where like the crime fighting cobblers.
Yes.
Dustin Hoffman and Sandler, they're teaming up at the end and they're like, yeah, and there's the laundry guys and there's all these other. You could have like a DCU, like or like a Marvel Extended Universe of different people with like blue collar jobs in New York.
Right. So the second film is just a superhero movie.
Yes.
And it just explores this world and emerges from the revelation at the end. I think we had this exact same observation when we talked about it the first time.
Oh, yeah.
But they could do spin-off movies too, like they're doing with the Star Wars stories.
Yeah. Like there's one about the garbage men and their special powers. There's one about tailors. There's a million deli owners. It's a million of them.
They all sound too interesting, though. I think you're way expanding the cobbler universe. I mean, this should be like the milliner. That sounds bad. I mean, I'm sure 98% of Adam Sandler fans are going, what the fuck is a cobbler?
Yeah.
That's true, yeah.
It's a peach dessert.
Coming this fall, haberdashery.
There you go.
So do you want to talk about your life?
No, not particularly. I think we've covered it between the cobbler and homeboys.
I got the gist. I mean, I read the book. I don't want to give too much away.
It's all in there.
I don't know, all the coke-fueled threesomes in the 80s, though. That was a blast to read about. Well, then let's cut to The Simpsons. You were there from day one.
From day one.
Everyone thought it would be a massive failure.
That was it. There one of our writers, Jay Kogan, is the son of a very famous TV writer, as famous as TV writers get. And his father begged him not to take The Simpsons job. He just knew it was not only not going to be successful, but it sounded like career poison. I don't know why, to work on a cartoon show on the Fox Network, which was a brand new entity at the time. Yeah. And nobody wanted to do it.
And Fox had not had a hit by then, right? Was 21 Jump Street
Married
on
with
the
Children.
Air?
Married with Children was a hit from
by
the first
1989?
Night. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No.
Oh, okay. It debuted as a hit, and the critics liked it too. And then 21 Jump Street was a hit. It was a little strange. Everybody was so against it. But I took the job. I wanted this other job. I was working on It's Gary Shandling Show, which was on Fox. It was the lowest rated show on TV. And I was on summer break, and Alan Zweibel, the creator of the show, was doing a show called The Boys. And it starred Norman Fell, and it was set at the Friars Club. And that's the gig I wanted, writing for Norman Fell. And I couldn't get it. I got turned down for The Boys, and my second choice was The Simpsons, which was the job nobody wanted. And I took it. And I didn't tell anybody what I was doing because I thought I've hit rock bottom.
Can you imagine, though, if you'd gotten that boys job, you could be on season 30 of The Boys with like a CGI Norman Fell or something.
You could be responding to all the fans who are mad that The Boys are just not as good as they used to be. And they don't like that the network made them add all these girls to it. And they think that's cultural Marxism. So, I mean, on paper, you had James L. Brooks, who was
James
very, very big, very successful producer.
Yeah.
And a network that was, it was cool, right? It was the edgy new network.
It wasn't cool.
It was more vulgar.
It was vulgar. It was
sleazy. That's what I mean. Yeah,
sleazy. You know, not like today. but yes, I mean, it had just a terrible reputation back then. And I just was not proud. It was a shipwreck of a project. They housed us in a trailer. They didn't even think we raided walls. So, but it was fun. And I think if there's a secret to the success of the show, it was we thought nobody was going to watch it. So it was a fun summer job, and we just did whatever we wanted.
And there had not been, and I had never really realized this, but there had not been a primetime animated show in the past 30 years.
Right.
Not
it was the Flintstones. It was the Flintstones. I mean, it was one in a row. It was just the Flintstones. The Jetsons weren't even a primetime show. I think that was a syndicated show. It was just the Flintstones and nothing else. And when we were starting the show up, we didn't even know how to do it. The poor animators didn't know how to crank out a weekly animated show because everyone who had done it was dead.
And get me Hanna and Barbera.
Yeah.
And,
well, this is coming at the end of the 80s, which in my opinion was basically a dead zone for TV animation. I mean, I grew up watching like the Saturday morning cartoons, so I guess I look at them, you know, fondly for that reason. But I mean, an objective appraisal is they're cheap.
No,
they're incredibly cheap,
very bad.
Shitty cartoons.
Yeah.
And then The Simpsons comes along, and you have Matt Groening, who is this underground cartoonist who's kind of a big deal, right?
Yeah, Life in Hell, yeah.
Yes, yeah. He was big. I was a fan of his. I'll tell the story real quick. It's in the book, which was he wrote a local cartoon strip, an underground cartoon strip, and it was here in the Village Voice, too, about rabbits. They look just like The Simpsons. It was called Life in Hell, and they just had giant ears. And that's why Marge has her tall bouffant. Was his conception at the time was when the show ended, the last episode, Marge would take her hair off and she had giant rabbit ears underneath. And, you know, It seemed like a good idea at the time.
They could still do that. Don't count it out. It's
possible. That would not be canon. We've seen Marge with her hair down multiple times.
He had two ideas. The other idea he had was that, you know, and again, he didn't know what the show would turn into. He said, Homer is crusty. And you didn't know that.
No.
If you've seen certain episodes where Krusty's got his makeup on,
yeah.
He looks exactly like Homer. And this was Matt's scheme. He said, oh, it'll be a great irony that Bart loves Krusty and hates Homer. And then the big reveal at the end is all these years, Krusty has been Homer.
Oh my God.
That would have been our last episode. Marge is a rabbit. Homer is Krusty.
That would have blown people's minds.
That really would have blown. Yeah.
But my point in saying that is that Groening's art, you know, that was a very unique thing to bring to television. Like, you hadn't really seen, I mean, arguably, like, any, like, interesting or unique animation in decades.
Yeah, well, certainly, yeah, the Flintstones look good. It's the hardest thing in the world, because I've done other animated projects, including The Critic, where to make something where it looks completely different and yet instantly appealing, and that's what The Simpsons are. You just like them. You like them when you see them. The Critic was designed by committee, and it really looks it, and no two characters look the same, and it just never looked right. So,
and another thing that you note, and of course, The Simpsons premieres, and it was a huge, huge success
instantly
upon premiering.
From the first night, yeah.
And something you note that's, you know, kind of unique about it, that was a kind of the new trend, is just the Gatling gun of jokes in the show. Even in the first season, which was slower objectively than the seasons that emerged in the mid-90s. And nothing had really had that kind of comic brio on television up to that point, except another show that I think you said you worked on, Sledgehammer.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Right? Did you?
I did work on Sledgehammer. Yeah. It didn't move as fast as you may remember, but it was fast and funny, and it did a lot of pop culture jokes.
Well, it was aping that Airplane style, which was also like kind of an early forerunner.
It hit me the other day. Oh, Airplane. That's what changed everything. I like to think it was us.
Yeah, let's get those guys.
Yeah, I remember I was in college, and they were testing Airplane. They had this very half-assed version of it. They were showing it didn't have an end. Didn't have a score, and they showed it at Harvard, and I remember I was with Al Jean, and we're going, wow, that's really good. That is special and different, and 3 years later, we got a job writing Airplane 2. Airplane 2. They call it Airplane 2.
Was that the one in space?
It's twice as good.
Yeah, that's the one they go to the shuttle to the moon.
It's a very funny
Bono.
Very funny movie about the space shuttle blowing up. And we did that.
I like the promotion you did for it in 1986. I think Sledgehammer is best remembered for it. It was Sledgehammer was this irreverent, kind of absurd cop show parody.
Right. Yeah, Dirty Harry, send up.
And I think it was best remembered for, they thought the show would be canceled, so they ended the first season with a nuclear bomb going off in Los Angeles and killing everyone. And then they were picked up for a second season.
Yeah. I was gone from the show. I was like anyone else. I'm going, how are they going to get out of this? And it was the creator of the show, Alan Spencer, just had the smart, cheap idea to show the end of the last season, the bomb goes off, and then the title came on, Sledgehammer, the early years. And now they want, again, you know, just like The Critic, two seasons, languishing in the ratings, and now they want to bring it back. They want to reboot it, and luck.
People are terrified of new ideas. They don't want anything new.
So the Simpsons premieres, and you also got the job because, and this was a kind of a running joke in the book, because Tom Gamble and Max Prost turned it down.
Right. I got Airplane 2 because they turned it down, and then I got The Simpsons because they turned it down. And I'm just waiting to see what they'll turn down next, because they've been a godsend to me.
Yeah, that should be, you know, that should have a column in Variety, whatever they decline. So who was there with you? Who was gay?
We were all gay. And again, that, I think, came across in the show. That was what we were shooting for. So it was, we didn't even work, you know, that first season, we were all kind of scattered. Because again, it was this smelly trailer with bad carpeting. And So it was like we didn't have a writer's room. We would sit with Sam Simon and write some scripts. And then we had John Vitti, John Swartzwelder, George Meyer. That was the team. Oh, and Jay Kogan and Wally Wolodarski. But no real writer's room. We didn't work as a group too much. And then second season, we all wound up in a room together.
And Matt told me when he got your book, he immediately just searched for Swartzwelder's name.
Yeah. Yeah. It shows you, if you want to be a phenomenon, if you want to be an international man of mystery, you don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
He's just a regular guy. He didn't seek this out. He's just a guy doesn't go to parties and doesn't feel like giving interviews. And that's it. And suddenly that's made him J.D. Salinger. He's Banksy, yeah. You know? And when you meet him, I mean, he wrote really funny scripts. He wrote 59 episodes of The Simpsons, 3 solid seasons of the show. And you meet him, he's just like one of your dad's friends. He's a Republican who smokes. He wears dress shirts. He loves to talk about baseball and old Westerns. He's the least mysterious man you've ever seen in your life.
I don't know. Some of his comedy I find very enigmatic. And you quoted this joke in the book. When people ask, where is Springfield? He just says, Springfield is in Hawaii.
Yeah, I like that. He has a couple of good quotes. He says, someone asked him what is his secret of writing Homer is. He says, I write Homer as a big dog. And it suddenly makes sense. And he loves Homer. He made Homer what Homer is.
Yeah.
But he would turn it in scripts and we go, well, this is a very nice script, but where's Marge and Lisa?
I just put the girl in somewhere. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's apparently he loves Homer. If you ever read his books, the Frank Burley books, I mean, they kind of read like Simpsons scripts that everyone said this is too crazy to do.
Yeah, anybody who loves Swartzwelder, loves his books, loves his scripts, buy his books. He just keeps cranking them out. It's clear, you know, nobody told him he doesn't work at the show anymore. He just keeps churning these very, very funny, crazy books out.
Is that a real publisher, Kennydale Books?
I think that's the street he grew up on, Kennydale.
So he's not really a recluse.
He is not a recluse.
Well, where does he live? I want to go harass him.
It's so funny because I could give it away where a diehard fan could find it instantly. But he lives on a ranch, and it's, you know, I've never been there, but I hear.
I assume he'll shoot you if you see someone coming up the path.
Get off my property. He just mentioned one day offhand, I have every newspaper ever printed. It's like, what? There's a good story. A woman who used to write for The Simpsons went over to Seinfeld, and when they were working on Kramer, she would just pitch these things that Swartzwelder said, and they would always go, too crazy. So things he said were too crazy for Kramer.
What was the one he said about Lincoln?
I think he said Abraham Lincoln was an asshole. The other thing he did, when he got high, he'd been a very successful advertising man. And then I think he was, I don't know what turn his life took, except he knew a lot about soup kitchens. He really would tell you he knew way too much about what they served at soup kitchens. So he drove the world's worst car that had no upholstery. He just had springs. And so you think, all right, maybe he's not doing so well, but he's working at The Simpsons. He's making a decent living for the first time. And he takes the money and he bought a painting by Hitler.
That's the kind of thing that's funny in the 90s, but today you get the wrong impression of someone.
Yeah. I think just purely for the art. It was a little landscape. I remember a watercolor. He comes in with it, and it's like, shouldn't you get car upholstery first? Isn't that the priority?
Oh, I found the paragraph in your book. Not all of the craziness was confined to his script. Swartzwelder would often make pronouncements like, the best exercise is to run 10 feet as fast as you can and then stop short. Or, Lorne Greene invented rap music.
Yes, that was a good one. Again, too crazy for Kramer. So,
now, the first season was not without controversy, obviously. And the big one that people still discuss to this day, a mystery that you resolved in your book, was why was Smithers black in the first episode? And I always assumed, not the first episode, but I always assumed that it was some kind of like color correction thing. You know, some kind of production error.
No, it was, you know, we knew we should have people of different colors on the show. Even then, that was it. We made Smithers black, or sort of, he's olive colored. He's green, really.
Yeah, it was odd.
That's the Simpsons palette, but he was black. And, you know, we make the shows, we see him in rough black and white animation. And it was only when they rolled back in color, we said, oh, this looks terrible. It's the one black guy in the show, and he's kissing up to his boss all the time. And, you know, it really had a plantation feel. So we just went, okay, he's white now. But so then, you know, we chose our main characters who would be black and white and Asian. But we told the animation house, look, make sure when you see a crowd, there's some black people in them. And this is, we're telling this to our animators in Korea. And the next show came back, and anyone who was homeless or a criminal was black.
Why is the show animated in Korea?
Well, you know, we always thought it's cheap, right? I always assumed that we all felt kind of guilty. These must be sweatshops or something like that. And it turns out Korean animators make more money than American animators. And it was the work of one guy. It was a South Korean animator, came to America. He did all the early Pink Panther cartoons. And when he got established, he went back to his home in Seoul and set up these big studios. So it was just, that's where the good work is done.
Huh. It was that, and like, it was like Eastern Europe too, right?
Yeah, Eastern Europe. They would make very, you know, we parodied it famously on the show, the worker and parasite cartoon. And that's no joke. I went to the Slovakian Animation Festival, and they had a night of Slovakian cartoons. And you just wanted to
project it on the side of a goat?
It was out in a park. It was a wall. It was shown on a wall kind of overgrown amphitheater. And you watch these cartoons.
Capitalism has been successful.
You just wanted to drink bleach. You just said, all right, now I'll kill myself.
So Simpsons, huge phenomenon right off the bat. And you write, Simpsons Mania was 1990 was the height of Simpsons Mania. It was impossible not to get excited. Simpsons t-shirts were everywhere. Bootleg Simpsons t-shirts were even more widespread. Black Bart, Mexican Bart, Bart smoking a joint, Bart stuck in a woman's ass. Fox hired bootleg police. That's a thing, apparently.
Yep.
Who impounded millions of illegal t-shirts. How does Fox have this army to impound merchandise?
We brought in the bootleg police, the bootleg army. Yeah, and it was some insane number, like 35 million t-shirts. Mm. They rounded up.
Who's making this?
It's not hard to make a t-shirt, dude.
They far, far outnumbered the real t-shirts, but we had 35 million of these shitty t-shirts. And there was this idea, let's give them to Ethiopia, right? Just send them there. And then somebody said, how is that going to look where you see a field full of starving Ethiopians wearing Bart Simpson t-shirts?
Yeah. So. My favorite knockoff were the Gulf War themed ones, where Bart is in the military outfit and he's strangling Saddam Hussein, or he's launching a missile into Baghdad or something, and it's like, eat my shorts, Saddam.
They really got the show. I wrote that one, by the way.
Well done.
Yeah.
When I was going through the book, I'm looking through my notes now, and I just kind of flagged all the things that made me go, aha, I never realized it. And apparently to you, too, one was that Arnie Pie's helicopter traffic report is called Arnie in the Sky instead of Pie in the Sky.
Right. Did you get that joke when you saw it?
I got that.
I don't
that.
Think I did.
I got
I think because of the rhyme
it
doesn't, you know, doesn't register.
Joke.
Okay, well done.
I got it.
Well done.
Simpsons, yeah, it's just full of...
In fact, I remember sitting back and being like, ah, Arnie in the Sky.
You just,
classic.
Wow.
You stroked your beard.
Wiping like, your eyes. Whoa.
I pity the sad fools who are watching this episode and not getting that joke. They're robbing themselves of humor by being dull.
Well, did you get this one? 10 years after Jeff Martin named Homer's Barbershop Quartet the B-sharps, I looked at a piano and realized there is no B-sharp. Also, how did you look at a piano and realize that? It's just keys. There's no letters.
I know how a piano works. I can do other things.
Oh, and one interesting one was the clown bed that Homer makes for Bart.
People are really taking a shine to that.
It's a real bed. It was
father made that bed. Just to back up, it was just Homer made a clown bed. It was just a bed shaped like a clown's body with a big clown face at the head of it. And he made it for young Bart, like toddler Bart. And it scared the shit out of Bart. And he sat up all night hugging his knees going, can't sleep, clown will eat me. And that became a gif and a meme and all those things I don't understand. But my father built that bed. He built it. And the face was even more horrifying. And it was good. It was my brother. It was for my little brother, who's an artist. So I said, recreate the bed. And he drew it. It's in the book. You can see my father, a lovely man, terrible carpenter, worst painter. He was the one he drew. So the clown had a big pink nose and nostrils. And it's like anyone who draws a clown knows no nostrils on the clown. And then just these big gaping black eyes, soulless dead eyes on the thing. So we had to saw the head off the bed. It was too scary. So now my brother, for the next 5 years, slept in a clown body with a neck stub. And we didn't throw that in the head. We just shoved in the back of his closet. So it was like the movie It. You'd open his closet and see this leering clown in the back.
That's good for you. That's good as a kid. Builds character.
So you take us through the steps of producing an entire Simpsons episode, and it's a lot of steps.
23 steps.
23 steps. I think two of those were joke steps, though.
Yeah. Wow, that's close reading. I never thought anyone would read this. A lot of people fought their way through it. It's 23 boring steps, because everyone asks, how do you make the show? I really want to know. And then, we do the fourth rewrite of blah, 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 and they're so zoned out. So I put it all down there, and I thought it'd be really boring. And then I had to read the audio book, and even I'm there, Jesus Christ, how many more steps is this? It was so painful just to read it, but it really shows you it's hard work.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess we'd be blasé about it, too, because people ask us how we make the show. And it's like, what do you want to hear? We roll out of bed at 4 p.m., we get drunk, and then we find our way to a microphone.
I know you do 23 versions of every show. We can make it tighter. This question can be more incisive.
Yeah, all of our shows are recorded 9 months in advance. So we do a live table read where we play it for other podcasters and friends.
They get edited down, actually, from originally about 4 hours. And then we have to slowly cut down to about an hour to an hour and 20 minutes.
You live in New York, but you fly in, what, once a week?
Yes. About 12 years ago, I cut down to a day a week at the Simpsons. I go in every Wednesday, and Wednesday's just like any other day of the week there. And I hated L.A. I hated it every year, the 26 years I lived there. So my wife said, well, let's get out of here. The Simpsons won't run forever. And so and she said she noticed I complained the least in New York. So we moved to New York, and that's it. For the past 12 years, I fly to L.A. Tuesday night. I work Wednesday, and I fly out on a red eye Wednesday night. And I'm like a carpetbagger where I'm proud. I don't even spend 24 hours a week there. It's about 22 hours.
What didn't you like about L.A.? That's surprising, because most people, they get sick of New York and move to L.A.
Oh, I've just been happy every day in New York for 12 years. L.A. just sucks. I mean, I can be boring about it. Oh, the traffic. It's terrible traffic and spread out. And that's all you need. It's just anything you want to do is this time suck.
Yeah.
You get there, you're in a bad mood. Maybe you'll have a good time. Then you got to get back in the car. There's traffic at 2 a.m. You'll hit a traffic jam at 2 a.m. You go, what the hell is this? and then on top of it, it's just not that great anyhow. It's ugly to look at. The museums are terrible. The restaurants aren't that good. I think show business and entertainment would be better if the business was set anywhere but L.A., if it was in Albuquerque or somewhere, Columbus.
Well, you know who we can blame for it? Thomas Edison.
Yes, I know.
I blame him for a lot of things.
Wait, what?
Well, he had a patent on early film technology. And the original movie studios were all in New York.
In Jersey,
and they would shoot in lots in Jersey or in like streets in New York. But they were always getting hassled by Edison's goons. He would literally send goon squads to like knock over their shit and try to extort money out of them for using his technology. And the early studio heads just moved. They said, where can we go? They'll be the farthest away from Edison and his army of thugs. And it was in LA.
Where the traffic is so bad, they'll never be able to get to us on time.
In fact, one early director, Thomas Ince, actually had a cannon in front of his studio as a way to sort of like intimidate the Edison goons.
Well, this is all to make films that are called like Man Washing a Horse.
Yes.
Very ironic for Thomas Ince, wasn't that? Yeah. His cannon didn't save his life.
It did not, from William Randolph Hearst.
Back to the
show. Old Hollywood.
Back to the show. That was a great anecdote.
He directed in our first season. That's how old the show is. Let me tell you a story, though. Speaking of old Hollywood, we work at Simpsons at the Fox. We work at Fox in the new Writers Building, and they call it the new Writers Building because it was built in 1932, and it's old. And one day, we work on the second floor. Al Jean is leaning against the balcony, and it just gave way. The whole thing fell, just this giant chunk of wood. He could have been killed. But so then I was at a film function, and they're showing a newsreel from 1932, and they go, and here we are at the opening of the new Writers Building at Fox. And who came in to cut the ribbon? Why, it's Leon Trotsky. And he christened our building.
It wasn't him. It wasn't actually him.
It wasn't him.
No, it was an impersonator, as it was part of a publicity stunt to promote some movie about Russians.
I'm out of here. Good day.
I know where Trotsky was every day of 1932. He was not in Los Angeles. He was busy conniving against the Bolshevik Revolution.
It wasn't Trotsky.
He was busy running his international campaign of sabotage.
He was sawing away at the balcony. Someday Al Jean will be here. He's like Boris Badenov.
But so, you know, in your book talking about The Simpsons, you touch on that hot button issue of what's the problem with Apu?
Oh, yeah.
And apparently he wasn't to be an Indian person, an Indian American. He was a just generic clerk.
It was clerk, and his line was 35 cents, please. And at the time, it wasn't a racial thing. It was just a comedy cliche, even in 1989. That all convenience stores clerks were Indian. And it was probably based on reality for some reason. That might have been something they gravitated to. So I put in the script, clerk, 35 cents, please. Underneath, I wrote, he is not an Indian. And then we get to that line at the table reading. And I think the story I hear is Sam Simon leaned over to Hank Azaria and said, yes, he is. And Hank read it with an Indian accent, and it just got this giant, giant laugh. And Apu was an Indian from then on. And, you know, I got to say, for 25 years, nobody ever complained about Apu. And Indians would say, he's the only Indian on television. Mm. So even now, I don't know. I don't know how big this controversy is, or I don't know how many offended Indians there are. But a guy made a documentary, and that's been the end of Apu. Or in fact, just to clear the matter, because I didn't realize this, 2 years before the documentary, we already said, all right, this is an issue.
Yeah.
We made our own episode. We did that documentary, but faster and funnier with the same jokes, where we had an actual Indian actor on the show play Apu's nephew, and he tells him, you sound like a white guy doing an Indian accent. And then we retired Apu. Nobody seems to have noticed, but you haven't seen him in 2 years.
Wait, so he is retired. You've retired Apu. I haven't
seen him in 2 years. He hasn't had a line.
Well, I watch him on FXX, so they come on like
they
later.
Do come on.
And
you
in
know,
a strange order, usually.
We're not going to, I don't know. I don't think we're going to erase the past, and I don't know what to do. I don't know, but there certainly are people out there offended by the character, but
yeah.
I've never met one of them. They all come up to me, I like Apu, or they go, he's the stereotype like everyone else on The Simpsons. And, you know, I think they like that inclusion. But I don't know. It's not my issue. Fine. We got 199 other characters. Yeah. Nobody notices he's gone.
Well, as you make clear in the narrative, it's not your fault.
Yeah, I guess so.
You know, another thing about that is I never got the understood the you know premise of the Bumblebee Man until I visited LA and I turned on the television and I see one of the Spanish language shows and it's just this fat man in a diaper and he's got like sauces spilled all over him. He's crying and there's no dialogue. I just hear the studio audience laughter, just huge gales of laughter.
Yeah, it was a show. You know, when you live in L.A., your first 30 cable channels are Spanish TV. And whatever the fuck this he was a cricket. It was a regular man dressed in a cricket outfit. And it was on all the time. And you'd flip from channel to channel. It was always on. And it's funny because I've heard the show still gets, in South America, 95 million viewers a week. It's this giant hit. And the other funny story I heard was the guy who plays the cricket, it's like us doing The Simpsons. He didn't think it would go anywhere. And apparently, at the time, he was like the Robert De Niro of Mexico. And now he's just cursed the next 50 years playing,
now he's
being
just a cricket, man.
The cricket diaper.
Oh, God.
You talked a little bit about the celebrity guests you've had on. You had Dustin Hoffman on famously as Lisa's substitute teacher. Why did he agree to appear under a pseudonym?
Yeah, it's one of those things. They drop it on you after they've recorded their part. And it's just two of them. I guess it's Dustin Hoffman and Michael Jackson. Didn't want to use their names. And we've never done that since. And I think it's been sort of a rule since then. That you gotta use your own name. But certainly, Dustin Hoffman, it places you in time. It was like 1992, and it didn't seem good for an Oscar winner to be doing a voice on a cartoon show.
But since then, you've had your fair share of Oscar winners.
Yes. Yes, we had.
Ooh, you also had George Takei come on. Takei? Is it Takei?
I think it's Takei.
All right, let me retake that line. You also had George Takei come on.
Takei.
God damn it. I'm going to get letters about this. And then you invited him back on to do the famous monorail episode. And he just said laconically, "I don't make fun of monorails."
Yeah. That was a shocker. He worked on, I think, the San Francisco Mass Transit Board and just thought this would hurt monorails, this episode. So we didn't get, and Takei had already been on the show, and he was fun, and so we wanted him back. And so we had to settle for our second choice, which was Leonard Nimoy. And he came on the show, and, you know, and how often do you want Sulu and you wind up with Spock? But he came on, and he said, "I'll do the show as long as you don't do any Star Trek jokes." And we go, fine. And so we wrote him a part, we record it, we animate it. And then at the end of the scene, we beamed him out of there like on Star Trek. We fucked Mr. Spock.
Take that, Nimoy.
Yeah, thanks for doing our show for $400. And then he did come back.
He did.
He came back in our Springfield Files.
Yes.
X-Files crossover. And it was, again, I'm directing him. And the show ends with everyone singing "Good Morning, Starshine." And, of course, Leonard Nimoy is famous for making a horse's ass of himself singing the Ballad of Bilbo Baggins.
Yes.
If you grew up in that era, I mean, it was just sort of, oh, okay. And, you know, here's two things I love colliding into something I really hate. So I'm directing him in the Springfield Files. It ends with everyone singing "Good Morning, Starshine." And I go, "Mr. Nimoy, can you really belt this out?" And he goes, "I know what you're trying to do."
You should have... After he recorded his lines, you should have inserted a whole bunch of anti-train stuff into that episode. just shots of trains blowing up.
Well, I mean, if you look at it a certain way, that could be seen as a episode hostile to mass transit. It's just a bunch of graft and unnecessary, bunch of, you know, so any sharp can show up and so pad his margins with bad material.
Created out of an attaché.
Yeah.
A guy in a straw boater came in and sold him a monorail.
Yeah, Mary would never fall for such a shameless huckster.
Never.
Ha!
It's a little satire. You touched on this a little bit earlier, but the fans. You travel the world.
Yes, I do.
And been to both the North and South Pole.
Yes, I have.
How? Yeah, how the hell do you get to the South Pole? Have only like 5 people done that?
To the South Pole? No. It's the North Pole nobody goes to. Because there's nothing up there. You're going to just go on. You go there, say, and come back on a podcast. Yeah, I went to the North Pole. It's gold.
It's like going to space to me. I don't.
Well, we wanted to do that too. That did not make the book. I forgot. My wife and I were in contention to go to Mars. They just needed a middle-aged married couple to go to Mars, and the presumption was and die up there.
Yeah.
They just said, let's get a middle-aged and childless, so who cares? And we volunteered. We got Neil deGrasse Tyson to endorse us, and then the whole project fell through. But, yeah, space. So, and we were talking on the ride over about going to Afghanistan. We had an Afghani driver saying, don't go there.
You told one story. I think this was in, it was either Tehran or South America, someplace like that, where
those two places are very similar.
Yeah.
I've never been to either place. How would I know? Maybe it is exactly the same.
What a coincidence.
No, you went to some place and you had a tour driver or something like that who was just harassing you and just saying anti-Semitic things.
Oh, yes. It was Australia.
Australia, that's right.
You were so close. You couldn't so be more close. Far off. Yeah, I'll tell the story with my great Australian accent that sounds like Cary Grant doing a cowboy. And it's, you'll see. Because we booked a tour of Darwin. I said it was Cairns in the book. This is bonus material you only get here. And he's taking us around and he says, what do you do, mate? And I said, oh, I write for The Simpsons. And he goes, that's a bloody stupid show. And I said, gee, everyone in Australia loves the show. He goes, yeah, my daughter loves it. Every time she quotes your show, I got to smack her in the face.
Jesus Christ.
I said, this is your daughter with leukemia you were talking about? He goes, yeah, that's the one. He says, I hate how you people make fun of religion on your show. And I said, well, that's funny because 2 weeks ago we were just endorsed by Pope Benedict. He goes, well, he's a bloody stupid wanker, ain't he? And then he shows us the waterfront in Darwin and he goes, as the waterfront, it's built by the Jews. They got no taste whatsoever. And I said, well, you know, I'm Jewish. And he taps me on the nose and goes, oh, I can tell, mate.
Nothing gets past this guy.
Yeah. So at the end, the tour ends, and I'm going, how much do you tip the anti-Semitic child beater?
Well, you got to tip big or else.
Yeah. And so as I'm leaving, he goes, you mind if I get an autographed script from my daughter? And I go, no, it'd be my pleasure. And he goes, and one for me, too.
I read that, and I just thought, of our own fans immediately, because that's roughly, those are our interactions with them. They inveigh against us constantly, explain how we're doing our jobs incorrectly, and then they say, yeah, where's the next episode? I want to listen to it.
I don't get it. Yeah, I don't get it. It's the Simpsons fan sites. None of us can bear to look at them, because they're so mean. And Al Jean, who's run the show for 20 years, we'll just wade through all this bile every week just in case there's a nugget of helpful feedback, you know? And they're the ones who told us, oh, Homer's getting too mean. Homer's getting too stupid. And Al absorbs that, even though the previous 100 comments are, Al Jean should die. There was one week he was in a car wreck on the way to the office. Oh my God. He just typed, I think, he tweeted, oh, I was in a car wreck. I made it to work in time. And someone wrote, I wish you had died.
And people would come up to you and they, at like conventions and stuff, they would say very, you know, nice things about you and the show. And they would say, oh, yeah, by the way, I'm Al Jean Should Die 67
yeah,
on this website.
Yeah, those guys.
Yeah, I'm the guy who bitches about your show every single week. But you do touch on, you know, the big criticism, which is that the show's not as good anymore.
Yeah.
And I thought that the point you made was pretty good that, you know, look, I mean, the show's been on for like 30 years. If at a certain point you know, you do so much with the original premise. The show has two, you have two paths you can take. One is to become boring like MASH did, or to become zany like Seinfeld did. And you obviously pick zany.
We pick zany. We try to be boring when we can. I mean, whenever anyone comes in with a real life kind of grounded story we haven't touched on, it's like, wow, great, let's do it, you know. But we got to make shows. And so the show at least gets weirder and faster and funnier, we hope. Even it can't be fresh. It can't be new. We can't get away with a story like Lisa is sad anymore. You know, everybody in the Simpsons family has been to jail. Some of them multiple times. Even the baby. They've all, whatever the baby is called. They've all been to jail. We're out of those, you know, grounded normal stories, but we'll keep going. We'll keep going. People can stop watching when they get tired of it.
And because nobody wants the show to end. I mean, like, in the room, you don't want the show to end.
We don't
want
to
have a blast
end.
Doing it.
It is really fun. I really enjoy, you know, that's why I fly across country. I really love the job. I'm happy going into work. We get along. The whole crew gets along. I mean, the book, if you buy, and you must buy my book.
Buy the book.
There's some scandal on page 30, and then there's another scandal on page 220, and that's it. Nothing bad has happened there.
The drama never stops in this book. But it's not the money. You wrote in the book, and I don't know how facetious you were, that you are entitled to 1% of the profits of the show.
Correct.
And because of some accounting sleight of hand, you are entitled to nothing.
I have 1% of the Simpsons profits, and God bless them. I get a quarterly statement. Show is still not in profit. They lose a little on every T-shirt. It's no joke. I, you know, all that merchandise, 30 years, syndication, everything, theme parks, beer. Now they make beer. You know, we're so close to meth. And we make all that stuff. And, you know, every 3 months I get a statement. We are $150 million in the red.
They're and just doing it for the love of it.
That's it. It is a charity. We are Greenpeace. And I take it to an accountant or to a lawyer to look at it. And one guy finally told me, maybe your grandchildren will see something. I'm 58 years old. I got to start having children so they can have kids to get some of this Simpsons money.
But you did take a break from the show, and you and Al Jean went off and made The Critic.
We made The Critic.
A show that is, I mean, fondly remembered for being as funny as The Simpsons and as smart as The Simpsons.
Oh, that's nice. Well, that's great. Yeah. I'll tell you one more thing. The motivation of this book, you know, me and Klickstein are shopping it around, and he said, we got to write about The Critic. And I said, you know, I'm not really a fan of The Critic. And I'm not. It failed so much. And it's funny, but I wanted it to be more like The Simpsons, be heartfelt and cleverly plotted. And it's just jokes. So I tell Klickstein, and I said, I'm not really a fan of The Critic. And he goes, that's our angle. And he ran to the publisher. He doesn't like The Critic. And we go, and they lit up too. I guess they've never heard a show creator not love his own show. That was going to be the whole angle. My angry picture on the cover, hating The Critic.
That's interesting that you said you wanted it to be more heartfelt, because one of the reasons you point to for The Critic's failure is just the interference from the networks, which The Simpsons were immune to because of James L. Brooks made a deal with Fox and said, just let us do what we want. I want it in print.
Right.
And they did.
They did.
No notes whatsoever. But in The Critic, you took notes. You had to suck up to studio heads of two different studios.
Right. It was just sort of built into the show. It was not a warm...
Normally, those people are the ones saying, too many jokes make it more heartfelt.
Yeah, they were fine. And when we were on ABC, they couldn't... You know, they didn't want to do the show. They knew it would be trouble, but Jim Brooks had a deal. Whatever he brought them, they had to put on ABC. So we put it on the air. We opened. We had great reviews. We had huge ratings. And 2 days later, my secretary walks in with a big box, and I go, what's that? And she goes, that's hate mail. And there's two more boxes in the hallway. And ABC was right. The people who watched ABC hated The Critic, and we were gone in 6 weeks. You know, what I thought The Simpsons would last 6 weeks, that finally came true. This is what people do to a show they don't like. and we were off the air. And then we went to Fox the next year, where we were a hit. We were a big hit following The Simpsons.
Yeah.
But the new president of Fox just hated the show. And he'd call me every week. I hated this week. Every week. Hi, it's John. I'm calling. Yeah, I know what you're calling. You hated the show. And he just yanked it off the air after 10 weeks, I think, and replaced it with a show called House of Buggin'.
John Leguizamo. House of Buggin'.
House of Buggin'. That was the problem with the critic. Not enough bugging.
Not enough.
And then the guy bugging. Then the guy lost his job a few months after
that. Right after that, the man came. He was literally at Fox long enough to come in, hate the critic, cancel the critic, put on House of Buggin', and then he got fired. And he's never resurfaced, you know? He's never been seen again. You Google him, and it's just 1992 to present, question mark.
He's living in the
House of Buggin'.
The fall of the House of Buggin'.
So after that, you did a few other jobs, and then you got to make Queer Duck.
Queer Duck,
for
yes.
The internet, for dial-up internet.
That, we, you know, it's abused the term ahead of its time, but we were making 3-minute cartoons for the internet that took an entire evening to download. And people would tell me, oh, yeah, I just set the internet going. I set the download before I go to bed. And when I wake up in the morning, there's half your 3-minute cartoon.
And a few months after that was the dot-com crash and a small recession that took place in the early 2000s.
That was it. It was Queer Duck was on. It was very popular. It broke the dial-up internet when it came on. It was so popular. And it's still the thing I'm proudest of. You can see them all on YouTube. But Queer Duck, it was about a gay duck and gay cartoon characters. And there were just, I had just read an article that there were, and this is 2000, there were no gay characters anywhere on TV.
It was after Ellen's off the air?
Yeah, it was pre-Ellen.
Really? I thought Ellen was 90s.
They might have, that was straight Ellen. There was a straight Ellen.
But she came out on the show.
It was not, it was, I'm telling you, I was first. I'm telling
okay.
you.
Okay.
I was the first one with this thing.
Wait, and, didn't Queer Duck go on TV after Queer as Folk?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow, my whole story, whatever.
No, you were the first.
No. Somehow this works. I think Queer, whatever. 2000. All right.
Sorry.
I'm not even Mike Reese. I'm sorry. Your door was open. I saw a soda. I said, I believe it's true, though, that at the time in 2000, because by the time it was hitting Showtime, it was 2001, when all of TV was gay. So, I don't know. He was the first. And, you know, 3 days after it aired, a reporter flew in from Germany to interview me about Queer Duck. And I'm not gay. And so I kind of had to hide my straightness, my undeniable machismo.
This is what the liberals want, by the way. Well, I mean, I saw Queer Duck after the fact online, and it's delightful. I highly recommend it. It's a sort of campy kind of humor that you don't see that often.
Yeah, it was so much fun. It was, you know, after doing The Simpsons so long where everything's been done, here was the first gay cartoon character where it was wide open. I go, oh, let's do the gay Christmas episode, brand new territory, Halloween, whatever I felt like. It was so much fun to do. And the fans loved it. The fans were really, really happy. And I won every gay award you can win. And
nobody was really upset that it was created by a straight man.
I didn't say it. I didn't come out. I'm straight. I just didn't say anything. And a reporter came to the house once, and I hid my wife in the bedroom, and I took down our wedding photos. I mean,
again, what the liberals want.
I didn't blow the guy, but I never said one way or the other. And then I was finally outed about a year into it by the New York Times. Said they wrote about Queer Duck, and they liked it, and they said Mr. Reese, who is straight, and my father, who didn't believe anything until he saw it in the New York Times, was so relieved. Finally.
And then Queer Duck released a movie in the mid-2000s. I saw the Queer Duck movie. I liked it a lot.
I'm very proud of it.
Avoids third act problems. I like that. Always appreciate that.
It's a nice short movie. Yeah. It came out. Variety called it the best animated movie of the year. So take that, Ratatouille.
See, I didn't get Ratatouille. I saw like 5 minutes of it on TV, and I'm just thinking, what the hell is this?
It's a rat that can cook. What?
I hate that. Why? Awful. But no, I recommend it. I would recommend to the audience to check out Queer Duck. Definitely check out the Queer Duck movie. It's lifeless, a thrill ride.
They're all, I think, illegally on YouTube in beautiful prints. So I recommend it. Everything I've done is for free on YouTube. All the Critic episodes are on YouTube.
Pirate the Critic, pirate Queer Duck, but buy Mike's book.
Buy the book. Yeah, don't. And the illegal downloads of the book I've already seen. And with Russians. It's just a Springfield Confidential Russian PDF.
So collusion.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
Buy the book.
We will put a link to purchase the book. Mike Rice's book, Springfield Confidential, Joke Secrets and Outright Lies from a Lifetime Writing for the Simpsons. Also buy the Chapo Trap House book.
Yeah, buy that book too.
And of course, buy John Swartzwelder's books, the Frank Burley series. You have so many books to buy, listener.
How many of your listeners buy 8 books a year?
They buy no books. They're on the internet.
I don't know. Our fans are pretty literate. They'll get up to 3.
Yeah, they've read over 1 million posts.
That's a book. That's what
you don't
get. I'm just
saying they don't buy the books. They have no need to buy the books because the posts are free.
You can also find Mike on Twitter. What's your Twitter at?
My Twitter is at Mike Reese Writer. R-E-I-S-S is Reese.
Don't,
Mike Reese
Don't
writer.
Follow at Mike Reese.
Right, that's a sports writer.
Any possible Nazi.
Who knows?
Saw it online. Mike, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you
very
much.
What a pleasure. You guys are delightful. It was a lot of fun.
Till next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And every brother's down for one another. There's no mission that's too tall. Ain't no problem they can't solve. So come aboard this space too deep in the 21st century. Homeboys in outer space.